Welcome to the debate. Imagine a city where the sirens have finally stopped. No bombs are falling, the treaties are signed, and, you know, the international community is applauding.
Right. Peace has officially been declared.
Exactly. On paper, it's peace. But just outside the city center, families are quietly dying from contaminated water, systemic poverty is actively disabling human development, and local ecological collapse is basically being treated as a routine economic externality.
Which really begs the question, is that city truly at peace?
Right. And that's exactly what we're digging into today. We are examining a profoundly ambitious paper by Dr. Bichara Salileh titled Life Coherent Peace, an Autopoetic Life Value Anti-Violence Framework for Human and Planetary Flourishing.
It is quite the title.
It is a mouthful, yeah. But the premise is incredibly striking. It attempts to redefine peace not merely as the absence of war, but as the organized enablement of life capacities.
Because historically, I mean, we define peace as a negative, right? Non-war. It's this very clean binary that basically lets us ignore the devastation baked into our everyday institutions.
Exactly. But Salileh argues we need a positive, diagnostic definition of peace. So the central question before us today is this. Can we successfully operationalize this concept of life-coherent peace into a practical governance framework? Or does attempting to systematize biological needs and a relational love inherently risk collapsing into, well, a coercive bureaucratic technocracy?
And that is the crux of it.
Yeah. I take the position that Salileh's framework provides a robust, necessary, and incredibly practical protocol to replace our current life-blind economic and social systems with what the author calls a true civil commons.
And I come at this from a slightly different angle, because while I think the author's diagnosis of our societal ills is, well, it's nothing short of brilliant, I argue that the cure is structurally flawed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Despite the built-in safeguards, translating deeply subjective life capacities and biological concepts into, you know, administrative tests, it inevitably invites coercive life value and a really dangerous form of bureaucratic reductionism.
Okay, well, to understand why this framework is so necessary, we really have to look at the diagnostic grammar it builds. It synthesizes three major thinkers. You've got John Murtmery's philosophy of life value.
Right.
Humberto Maturana's biology of autopoiesis, and Johann Galtung's sociology of violence. Most of our listeners are highly familiar with the critique of what McMurtry calls the money sequence.
The idea that our systems use life merely as a means to generate more money.
Exactly. And we know that system is life blind. I mean, it can track GDP flawlessly, but it has no internal mechanism to register whether human thought, felt being, or, you know, ecological viability are actually flourishing.
It just measures the transactions.
Right. So Salileh provides the rigorous alternative, the life sequence, where life uses the means of life to generate more or better life.
Which is a beautiful philosophical concept, honestly.
But it doesn't stop at philosophy. That is the breakthrough here. The paper offers the Life Coherence Arbitration Protocol. It's an 8-step practical tool for evaluating policy and addressing conflicts. It operationalizes these theories, proving that organizing society around planetary flourishing can be a viable secular covenant.
A secular covenant?
Yes. It's an administrative blueprint, not just some utopian dream.
Look, I will certainly concede that the diagnosis of structural and cultural violence in this paper is astute, pointing out that a society can be completely free of armed conflict while still systematically disabling life through, say, medical exclusion or ecological destruction. That is a vital insight.
Absolutely.
But translating that into an administrative blueprint is precisely where I see a massive structural risk.
How so? I mean, we have to start somewhere.
Well, the entire framework relies heavily on Humberto Maturana's concepts of love. Now, Maturana doesn't mean, like, romantic love. He defines it biologically and relationally as accepting the other as legitimate in coexistence.
Right. It's a biological condition for social phenomena.
Yes. And Salileh wants to institutionalize this relational legitimacy into state infrastructures, the civil commons. But here is the unavoidable reality. Bureaucracies cannot love.
Well, let me finish this thought. When administrative systems, no matter how well-intentioned, are given the mandate to evaluate and govern intimate biological concepts like structural coupling or self-creation, they inevitably impose a standardized, top-down definition of what constitutes a valid life capacity.
I think you're assuming a rigidity that you end up recreating the very domination the framework seeks to dismantle. It's just wrapped up in the language of biology and care now.
But if bureaucracies can't love, how do we actually govern biological needs? We have to build infrastructure somehow, right?
We do, but the paper itself warns that bureaucracies tend to become cold and self-protective. Think about a sprawling public health system or a public education system.
Sure.
If a centralized state apparatus is dictating the terms of felt being and action, which are McMurtry's terms for human life value, it has to standardize them to administer them across millions of people. It has to say, this is the approved curriculum for expanding thought, or this is the approved metric for bodily viability.
It has to have standards, yes.
But by standardizing, it inevitably excludes the margins. It turns the profoundly intimate relational process of human autopoiesis, our moment-to-moment self-creation, into an administrative checklist.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. You are looking at the civil commons as if it's trying to replace human relationships with state administration.
It feels like it is.
But Saheli explicitly frames the civil commons as a social immune system. Now think about how an immune system actually works in the biological body. It isn't emotional. It isn't loving in any sentimental way. It is a biologically necessary infrastructure whose sole job is to prevent structural violence from destroying the host organism.
But immune systems can cause autoimmune diseases. I mean, they can become hypervigilant and attack the host itself. That is exactly what a bureaucracy does when it overreaches.
Exactly. Which is why a healthy immune system relies on regulatory T cells to check that aggression and to differentiate between a threat and the host's own tissue. The arbitration protocol accesses those regulatory T cells in the state apparatus.
Regulatory T cells in the bureaucracy.
Yes. To see how this works in practice, let's look at the paper's case study on municipal water privatization.
Right, the water shutoff scenario.
Yeah. So, when a municipality privatizes its water, it subjects a biological necessity to the money sequence. Water becomes a revenue stream. If a family cannot pay their bill, the water is shut off.
Which is standard practice.
In a life-blind economic system. Yes, that's just basic contract enforcement. Nothing went wrong. But biologically, water is a non-negotiable condition of what Maturana calls structural coupling, the recurrent interaction between an organism and its environment that allows it to survive without losing its identity.
Right. Without water, the organism dies.
Exactly. By shutting off the water, the system actively disables that family's thought, felt being, and bodily viability. It is a profound act of structural violence. The civil commons alternative doesn't ask the water treatment plant to, you know, love the family. It simply treats water as a baseline biological condition that cannot be commodified.
Okay, I follow the logic.
The infrastructure secures the baseline survival needed for relationships and true love to exist without coercion. It's not standardizing felt being, it's guaranteeing the hydration required to feel anything at all.
Okay, but water is an incredibly easy example. It's a bit of a straw man.
Is it?
Yes, because hydration is a universal, non-substitutable biological need. There is no cultural nuance to needing water. But governance is rarely just about whether to turn the water on or off. Governance is about what happens when genuine, unresolvable conflicts arise between different living unities.
Which happens all the time.
Right. So if the civil commons holds this massive infrastructural power to prioritize life capacity, how does it handle complex, tragic choices without becoming tyrannical? What happens when the state decides, say, housing is a biological need and seizes private property to build it?
Well, that's exactly what the Life Coherence Arbitration Protocol is built to navigate. It doesn't just say maximize life and do whatever you want. It provides a sequential filter.
Let's test that filter against the paper's own problem of tragic choice, because I think this exposes the profound optimism of the protocol.
Go for it.
The paper poses a difficult scenario. You have a displaced population urgently needing shelter and agricultural space to survive, but the only available land is an ancient forest that sustains incredible biodiversity, regulates the local water cycle, and carries profound cultural and spiritual meaning for an indigenous community.
A classic clash of vital needs.
Exactly. You have immediate human survival on one side and ecological, cultural survival on the other. Both sides invoke life value.
And both claims are entirely legitimate under the framework.
Exactly. So what does the protocol do? It instructs administrators to seek composable options, meaning find a way where both can flourish together. I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why.
Okay.
In reality, incommensurable values often force a zero-sum sacrifice. You cannot physically put a dense housing development in an ancient forest and keep the ancient forest intact. The protocol provides the illusion of a neat, harmonious solution, but in practice, it merely masks a forced technocratic decision.
You think it's a cop-out?
I do. An administrator in a room somewhere still has to choose whose life capacity matters more, but now they do it hiding behind the objective-sounding language of compossibility.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning because you are ignoring the rigorous constraints the protocol places on that exact decision.
What constraints? It's still a choice.
The protocol explicitly rejects the two false solutions we normally use to resolve these crises. First, it rejects the money sequence calculation, where we just assign a dollar value to the timber, a dollar value to the housing tract, and pick the highest number.
Agreed. That's life blind.
And second, it rejects abstract moral absolutism, where we just declare nature is sacred and let the displaced people starve.
But someone still has to pull the trigger on a decision. How does it avoid being arbitrary?
By forcing a rigorous, sequential ranking that is rooted in biological reality. Step 3 of the protocol requires distinguishing genuine life needs from wants or substitutes. Step 4 requires identifying thresholds of irreversibility.
Thresholds of irreversibility.
Yes. Think about how an administrator actually measures that in the room. If clearing that forest means the permanent extinction of a species or the total erasure of an indigenous culture, that is a threshold of irreversibility. The protocol flags that as a hard red line. You cannot reverse extinction.
So the displaced people don't get housing?
They do, because of step 6, which requires minimum sufficient force. The framework accepts that constraint and sacrifice are sometimes unavoidable in a finite world. It does not promise a magic wand that eliminates all pain.
Right.
But it demands that the intervention be the least dominating, least life-disabling option possible to secure the vital need. So in this scenario, maybe the displaced population needs shelter, but they don't need that specific ancient forest acreage if alternative degraded land is available nearby, even if building on that degraded land costs the state significantly more money.
So it overrides the financial cost.
Exactly. The framework disciplines the state's judgment around the life ground, rather than letting the state just throw up its hand, say it's too expensive, and let the market decide.
Okay, but this brings us to what I consider the most dangerous part of the entire framework, the language itself.
The language?
Yes. If arbitration requires ranking these needs and establishing biological thresholds of irreversibility, who actually gets to define the language and the terms used in this room? This ties back directly to Majorana's concept of languaging.
Okay. I see where you're going with this.
Right. Majorana argued that human beings quite literally bring forth worlds through language. Our reality is constructed through the distinctions we make when we speak to one another.
Which is why the paper is so critical of terms like collateral damage or human capital or economic externalities. Those are linguistic mechanisms that distance us from violence. They sanitize it.
Exactly. I agree entirely. But then look at what the paper replaces those terms with. It introduces its own highly specific, incredibly dense academic vocabulary. We are talking about autopoiesis, ontoaxiology.
Which, just to unpack for a second, means combining what is real with what is inherently valuable?
Thank you, yes. Along with structural coupling and compossibility. Now, if a centralized governing body uses this specialized vocabulary to define a local community's needs, aren't they imposing a specific Western academic epistemological framework?
You think the vocabulary itself becomes coercive?
Yes. Imagine an indigenous community trying to protect a sacred site. And the state administrator sits across the table and says, please articulate your claim in terms of how this development affects your autopoetic structural coupling.
Well, they wouldn't say it like that.
But the framework demands it. That is epistemic colonization. It risks reproducing exactly what Johann Gauting defined as cultural violence. You are forcing affected people to articulate their suffering and their worldview in the state's biological vocabulary just to be recognized as legitimate by the arbitration board.
If they don't speak the language, they lose the case.
Precisely. If you don't speak the language of ontoaxiology, your needs aren't recognized.
That's an interesting point, though. I would frame it differently. The author is deeply aware of this exact danger, which is why Step 7 of the arbitration protocol explicitly mandates require participatory languaging.
But what does that actually mean in practice?
The paper warns, in no uncertain terms, that a life-coherent vocabulary cannot be used as a moral weapon to silence people. The framework demands that affected communities are not treated as passive data points for a bureaucracy to measure. They are recognized as living observers who must actively participate in making the distinctions by which the problem is defined.
But if the framework's overarching mandate is life value, as defined by McMurtry, isn't the outcome already rigged? I mean, the state holds the pen.
No, because of Step 8, monitor, repair, and revise. The system is designed to be deeply recursive.
Recursive? Meaning it loops back on itself?
Exactly. Viability in any living system is maintained through ongoing feedback and repair, not a one-time architectural design. If the arbitration process erases a community's worldview or forces them to speak in a way that alienates them from their own cultural reality, it immediately fails the life coherence test.
How?
Because it has reduced the relational domain to domination. A process cannot be life coherent if it relies on epistemic violence to reach a decision. The protocol forces the institution to look at its own effects and ask, did our attempt to secure the physical means of life actually degrade this community's relational legitimacy? If yes, it has to be repaired.
I appreciate the inclusion of recursive repair. I really do. But we have to be brutally honest about how power operates in the real world.
Sure.
A state apparatus that has the power to define biological viability, evaluate structural coupling, and administer the civil commons is a massive, unprecedented concentration of power. Even if you mandate participatory languaging on paper, the power asymmetry between a displaced, stressed community and a state arbitration board is vast.
There's always going to be an asymmetry with the state.
Yes, but the state has the lawyers, the resources, the time, and ultimately the authority to interpret what minimum sufficient force actually means. My fear is not that the theory lacks safeguards. My fear is that in practice, life value becomes the ultimate trump card for the state.
A justification for anything?
Exactly. Any action, no matter how coercive or overreaching, can be justified if the state successfully argues it is protecting the autopoetic viability of the population. We have seen this historically. The most invasive dominating policies are almost always justified as being for the public's own health and safety.
But that's exactly why Saley integrates Gelting's entire theory of violence alongside Madurana and McMurtry. It is a brilliant failsafe.
A failsafe?
Yes. If the state uses coercion, humiliation, or exclusion to achieve a positive health outcome, Gauting's metrics immediately flag that as structural and cultural violence. You cannot achieve life-coherent peace through life-disabling methods.
But the state decides what is life-disabling.
No, the framework literally defines peace as the ongoing transformation of those dominating conditions. It holds the state accountable to a multidimensional test. You can't just maximize bodily health while destroying human agency and felt being. You have to enable the full spectrum of life capacities.
And that multidimensionality is beautiful to read in a theoretical paper. But put yourself in the shoes of a local administrator, okay?
Okay.
A stressed municipality is trying to allocate a shrinking budget between a failing water treatment plant, a collapsed housing sector, and a dying local ecosystem. Asking them to evaluate the ontoaxiological life value across all those domains simultaneously is a staggering administrative burden.
It's hard work, yes.
The risk is that under pressure, they will just default to whatever is easiest to measure. They will count hospital beds or gallons of water and ignore relational legitimacy entirely, which brings us right back to the bureaucratic reductionism I warned about from the start.
Or conversely, they use the life coherence test to realize that treating those crises as separate, competing budget line items is the actual root of the problem.
Mm.
If we step back and look at what this framework actually offers, it is a desperately needed exit ramp from the life-blind systems that are currently driving planetary collapse. If you are listening to this and wondering how autopoiesis affects you, just look at your local hospital's billing department or your city's zoning laws.
They are inherently life-blind.
Exactly. By taking the biological reality of autopoiesis, the undeniable fact that we are living, self-producing unities dependent on our environment, and linking it with a rigorous evaluation of structural violence, Sahaley gives us a diagnostic tool unlike any other. It stops us from confusing a rising GDP with actual human well-being. Yes, governance is incredibly hard, but the Life Coherence Arbitration Protocol provides a recursive, dialogical method to actually navigate those hard choices in service of human and planetary flourishing. It demands, fundamentally, that we subordinate money to life rather than subordinating life to money.
Well, to summarize my position, while I believe the critique of the money sequence is a brilliant, necessary intervention, I remain deeply cautious about this specific solution. Translating profound biological and relational concepts like autopoiesis, structural coupling, and the love required for true coexistence into a state-run governance protocol carries incredibly heavy risks.
The bureaucratic overreach.
The danger of coercive life value remains potent. Whenever a centralized system, no matter how heavily monitored by regulatory T cells, attempts to arbitrate competing fundamental life needs, there is a natural gravitational pull towards standardizing human experience. There is a risk of imposing an epistemic vocabulary on marginalized people and masking raw technocratic power behind the unimpeachable, universally appealing banner of life.
Well, I think where we absolutely converge today is on the profound utility of identifying life blindness in our modern institutions. We both agree that defining peace merely as non-war is dangerously inadequate.
Oh, completely.
It allows massive, systemic violence to persist completely unchecked under the guise of normalcy and peace treaties.
We are entirely aligned on that. The silence of guns is not the presence of peace. The tension that remains between us is whether this specific arbitration protocol can truly resist the gravity of becoming just another technocratic instrument of the state, or if it genuinely represents a paradigm-shifting way to govern.
And that is a tension our listeners will have to weigh for themselves. I highly suggest exploring Dr. Sahaley's source material, look deeply at the 8 steps of the life coherence test, and consider how you might apply them to the institutions governing your own life, whether that's your local school board, your healthcare provider, or, you know, your city council.
It is certainly a framework that irrevocably changes how you look at the mundane infrastructure around you.
Exactly. Because at the end of the day, when society looks at a crisis, we can't just treat it like an X-ray of a broken arm, binary, clean, fixed or not fixed. The landscape of human flourishing is incredibly murky and complex. But perhaps, with the right framework, we can finally stop staring at the silenced guns and start looking at what it actually takes to keep the water flowing, the mind thinking, and the body living. Thank you for joining us on The Debate.